Welcome to the first episode in our CME podcast series on improving the transition process for pediatric IBD patients. During this series, we will highlight a number of challenging cases. The series is sponsored by the Children's Digestive Health and Nutrition Foundation, along with the North American Society for Pediatric Gastroenterology, Hepatology, and Nutrition. A special thank you to CentiCor for providing support. I'm Dr. Tony Otley, Chair of the program and Associate Professor at the Department of Pediatrics at the IWK Health Center in Halifax, Canada. This podcast focuses on managing parents while building confidence in a 15-year-old patient. Our faculty is Dr. Lori Fishman, Assistant Professor in Pediatrics at Harvard Medical School and Director of Medical Education in GI at Children's Hospital in Boston, as well Janice Arnold, a social worker also at Children's Hospital, Boston.
So we're here today talking about the skills that are needed to build in patients prior to achieving transition and eventual transfer to adult care. We know that communication with a provider is one of the earliest skills that patients need to develop as a prelude to transition. And as an adult, patients are really expected to be able to answer questions, ask questions, and talk with their provider, really advocate for themselves. We know that one barrier to independence for young people can be their own parents. So let's take a case of Joe. He's a 15-year-old adolescent who I see with Crohn's, whose mother always answers every single question and never lets Joe get a word in edgewise. We've all experienced this scenario. So I'm about to see him again. What could I do differently? Janice, your thoughts?
Lori, one of the preliminary things I like to do is set up the nonverbal cues of expectations of the visit. So what I often find helpful is when I first walk into the room, I'll specifically sit next to Joe and a little bit further away from the mother and perhaps even re-choreograph the arrangements if that's necessary. I'll turn towards Joe, and if that means that temporarily or momentarily my back will be to the mother, I'll still face him. If they're sitting proximal to each other, then I'll very rigidly and deliberately maintain my eye contact with Joe and avoid transitioning to the mom. When I first enter the room, I'll automatically greet Joe first and then the mother.
Oh, this is a great way to start the visit. I agree. And setting up the physical expectations of the visit makes a lot of sense. Sometimes, though, when I've done this and the mother keeps jumping in anyway, I find I really have to directly address the issue. And before my next question, I might have to say to mother, first we're going to hear from Joe, and then we'll have you add information. Or if she's in the middle of a long discussion, I might have to interrupt her and say, you know, I want to hear what Joe says first, and then I promise you'll get to add your thoughts and observations. Sometimes I'll even use humor. Joe, you're not going to let your mom do all the work here, right?
Lori, I think humor is a great strategy to help disarm and make everyone feel a little bit more comfortable. Something else that can be very helpful is to get Joe talking about something that only he and not a parent can be the expert in and that invokes his own opinion. For example, which sports teams do you like? Who's your favorite player? What type of music are you listening to these days? These are questions that his mother can't answer. Then, when the topic switches to more medical information gathering, he'll be more likely to keep talking.
Which leads us right to the fact that teens sometimes just don't talk. Even when his mother is quiet, often Joe will just like hem and haw or mumble or say, I don't know. Like I'll ask him, does your belly hurt? I don't know. Do you ever feel like you might throw up? I don't know. That happens all the time. So sometimes what I need to do is actually give options, answers that are possible for my question. It seems kind of strange, but I think teenagers sometimes are so embarrassed about their answers, they're afraid they're going to say something odd or unusual. So if I ask a question and they're silent, I might give them options and say, what is your belly pain like? Is it burning? Is it stabbing? Is it sharp? Is it crampy? Sometimes a teenager will say, yes, it's crampy, but sometimes they'll just nod. And then I have to go back and confirm and say, so Joe, you think you're pain is achy or your pain is crampy. And if he nods again, then I can go on to the next question. He just may not be able to verbalize it out loud.
I do ask the same questions every visit, and I joke with them that eventually they can anticipate these questions. I sometimes tell them, you know, one day you're going to walk in and say, Dr. Fishman, I have no joint pain. I have no canker sores. My pain is like this. The number of bowel movements are this. And so they know that eventually they're going to be answering these questions. I do think we have to remember that teenagers are incredibly embarrassed about questions dealing with their body. Things that are embarrassing to adults are extremely embarrassing to children or to teenagers. And even those that look incredibly tough, incredibly sophisticated, those that are incredibly articulate, they're still embarrassed by these topics. And sometimes if they look incredibly embarrassed, I may say out loud, this is really embarrassing, isn't this? This is really gross to talk about poop. I sometimes tell patients that my own children are horrified that I come to work every day and talk about poop all day long. Janice, you talk to teens all the time. Do you have other techniques that you get them to get them to answer questions?
Sometimes it's something as simple as waiting a long time and remembering that silence in and of itself is an intervention. I try to remind myself not to give up and thereby not allow the teenager to give up. So when a mother might start to answer a question, I'll say, I bet Joe can answer this, so that we teach Joe that he won't keep getting rescued, and we teach Mom that Joe might not need the rescuing. Sometimes it's as simple as taking a break and saying to Joe, think about it for a little bit and we'll come back to it. There's no right or wrong answer. This again teaches Joe that we do think he's going to be capable of formulating an answer, but it removes the pressure-filled situation.
So we're running out of time, but I want to make sure we've covered everything. We've given a lot of tips to help teenagers talk with their providers.
And I think the bigger picture is remembering that transition to independence really begins with effective communication patterns. And so modeling for the parents ways to give their teenager permission to take a more active role is critical. In addition, we want to make sure as providers to set and convey expectations of the teenager's competency, albeit realistic ones, as well as convey to the patient our own confidence in their capabilities. Thanks, Lori, for such a great dialogue.
Thanks, Janice.
Thanks for listening to this episode in the CME podcast series on improving the transition process for pediatric IBD patients. Go to pedibd.org to subscribe to receive future episodes. I'm Tony Ottley.